You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. This is episode 271 of the Columbia Calling podcast. As always, get in touch at Twitter, at Columbia Calling, Facebook, Columbia Calling, and indeed over email, if you still use email, that is, columbiacalling@gmail.com. We've had a couple of great interviews in the last few weeks, and listener numbers continue to increase. This, of course, is in no small part due to the new news segment that we've added in a few weeks ago with Adrian Alsema, the director of Columbia Reports, the most widely read Columbia-based news site in English. So fantastic news for the Columbia Calling podcast. And well, this week it's a great honor to be introduced to and introduce you guys to the Halo Trust, which you'll hear more about in segment three of this show. And we're talking to the director direct from their offices in downtown Bogota. The Halo Trust is, of course, one of the premier humanitarian demining NGOs in the world. They work here in Colombia in various parts of the country. And we have the opportunity to talk with the director for Colombia, the Australian Ash Body. So very great opportunity for us to find out a little bit of what's going on in this respect around the country regarding landmines and regarding, of course, their destruction. What a terrible situation this country survives in with landmines in so many different regions. But I'm sure that the Halo Trust will put us straight and let us know exactly what the real situation is across Colombia. Anyway, so I'll leave you right now to in the capable hands of the director of Columbia Reports, Adrian Alsema, for this week, episode 271's news segment, and then we'll be back after him with segment three, talking to the director of the Halo Trust, Ash Body. Thank you again for listening, and of course, don't go away. Bye-bye.
My name is Adrian Alsema, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for April 30, 2019. Colombia's War Crimes Tribunal ordered the arrest of former FARC commander El Paisa on Friday. The order comes a year after El Paisa and almost 10 other former guerrilla commanders went into hiding. The former rebel chief lost confidence in the peace process after the United States requested the extradition of FARC leader Jesus Santrich on a vague drug trafficking claim. Unlike other FARC leaders, El Paisa ended his collaboration with justice. Because of this, he now has lost his right to freedom. Violence against Colombia's social leaders is increasing exponentially, a think tank said last week. According to Somos Defensores, aggression against community leaders and human rights defenders went up 66% in the first quarter of 2019 compared to the same period last year. 2018 was already the most violent year for social leaders, 155 of whom were assassinated last year. Many thousands of Colombians took part in anti-government protests on Thursday. The protests against the government's economic policies, opposition to the peace process, and treatment of ethnic minorities were largely peaceful. Violence erupted only in the capital Bogota, where police attacked journalists and hooded men attacked police. The fighting impeded the final event on the central Simón Bolívar Square and left 11 people injured. Colombia's State Council removed a second opposition politician from Congress in less than 2 weeks. House Representative Ángela María Robledo was the running mate of Gustavo Petro. They were granted a seat in the Senate and the House for ending second in last year's presidential election. But according to the State Council, Robledo failed to timely resign from Congress ahead of her announcement to join Petro last year. The House representative said her voters were robbed of their representation and vowed to challenge the decision. The chief of staff of President Ivan Duque resigned on Wednesday. Dynasty politician Jorge Mario Eastman was reportedly under pressure from Duque's Democratic Center Party over the president's failure to push legislation through Congress where they are in the minority. The resignation could make it even more difficult for the president to promote his party's far-right agenda. Eastman was one of the few people in Duque's inner circle with friendly ties with the more moderate powers that dominate Congress. The assassination of a former FARC guerrilla has again embarrassed Defense Minister Guillermo Botero. The FARC member was murdered by a military unit on Monday in Convencion, a rural municipality near the border with Venezuela. Botero initially claimed that the former guerrilla had tried to take a soldier's weapon, but this was later contradicted by the military. The regional commander went to the town to personally apologize to the community and the parents of the victim. This is the end of this week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, once again, after a couple of weeks in Montbos, enjoying the heat. This is episode 271 of the Colombia Calling podcast. I hope you've enjoyed the last couple of episodes. We've been discussing business storytelling consulting and indeed an art exhibition for women artists in London. And of course, that's been run by Daniela Galán, a Colombian artist based there. But this week we have a very special guest. We're changing tack again, as we like to do here on the podcast. His name is Ash Boddy. He's the director of the Halo Trust here in Colombia. For those of you who are not aware of the Halo Trust, it's a non-political organization that's dedicated to humanitarian demining, getting rid of landmines. And of course, they've had quite a serious presence here in Colombia for some time. So let me just welcome Ash onto the Colombia Calling podcast.
Yeah, Richard, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
That's perfect. Now, for those of you out there listening, you'll have heard that accent. Good day, Richard. Ash, you're from Australia. How long have you been here in Colombia?
I've been here since August of 2018.
I suppose, but a relatively recent arrival.
Yes, indeed.
Relatively recent arrival. So tell us a little bit about your background in the Halo Trust, because you've been in this company. Well, you're a lifer.
Well, not quite. So I was, in my previous life, I was an officer in the Australian Infantry. I came across mine action when I was working as a military observer in Sudan in 2005. And I was quite struck at the type of work they were doing, the impact that they were having, and the style of leadership. It was very familiar with what I knew from the military, but as a completely civilian organization. So in 2005, I left the Australian Army and I joined the Halo Trust in 2006. So I've worked on and off with Halo in Africa, in Europe, in the Caucasus, in the Balkans, in Southeast Asia, in Cambodia, some survey work in Sri Lanka, and this is my first time in Southern America, so I've been here since August of last year, and I hope to be here for the next couple of years.
So it was natural progression after all of those places to now come to Colombia. So I mean, it's like you've kind of ticked off every other place. Landmine problems. Well, have you been? You haven't been down to the Falklands then?
No.
So heavily mined.
Halo doesn't have a presence there.
Oh, really?
No.
Okay, right, very interesting indeed. So when we talk a little bit about your past in all of these different places, the Balkans, Africa, and so on, is there a place, a region that's affected you more seriously or more profoundly in terms of, I don't know, people maimed or killed exactly by the landmines, or the absolute, let's say, terrain that's just littered with them?
Well, it's a complete mixture of everything. So I very much live wherever I am. Mm-hmm. So I left Australia in 2005 as my home, and my home is wherever I am. Mm-hmm. So the training that I did in Angola, the scope and scale of the minefields that need cleared there is pretty exceptional. Mm-hmm. The minefield history of the battles that took place down in Kutukarval, the density of the mine laying in Cambodia, I think is quite unlike anything I've seen anywhere in the world. The impact that it has on very small countries in Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh, very small populations with a significant mine problem, which could be finished, you know, with the right degree of effort. I was so in terms of the total proportion of the population that's affected is incredible. Mm. So even though relatively small mine accident victim numbers compared to somewhere like Colombia, 11,700 odd mine victims in Colombia, you know, the impact that has on people's lives is the same here as it is anywhere in the rest of the world. It predominantly impacts the civilian community. It's a legacy of war that continues to fight long after, you know, the guns have been silenced. And it doesn't really matter where that is in the world. The impact is exactly the same. It generally affects the poorest of society, the people who have no other choice but to live there. So that's the real impact of the work that we do around the world. What we do is very simple. We stop people from killing or injuring themselves, and we restore livelihoods. We put land back to productive use. And in doing so, you know, we contribute, we are to as a precursor to development. Mm-hmm. So it's very different in every single country that I've been in, but the there is a constant that sort of remains through it, is the people who are affected by the mine laying, and the very definite need for this to give people the same opportunities as everybody else.
Wow. Would I be correct in saying, if we take somewhere like Angola, they're formal, let's say, landmines sold by arms dealers, or, you know, made into these, you know, the discs that we see or so on. Whereas here in Colombia, they might be more rudimentary, homemade landmines.
Yeah, so the vast majority of the mines that are affecting the Colombian population are improvised.
Yeah.
So that's not, you know, that's not specific to Colombia. Mm-hmm. We do see the same things in other countries. So the vast, you know, the improvised nature of landmines can be found in almost every country I've worked in. Mm-hmm. But in Colombia, they are exclusively homemade.
Right. So there's no one. I mean, not one side purchasing, let's say, from these arms dealers and so on.
No.
Wow. It's very interesting because, you know, many years ago, I went and interviewed in the engineers, Colombian engineers, army engineers, and so on, and went to speak to some of those soldiers injured by landmines, and terribly so. I mean, really horrific injuries. And of course, I was shown some of the remnants of these landmines, football stuff with explosives, and I learned that people couldn't take footballs. Actually, I worked for an NGO many, many years ago. And you couldn't take a football out as a present to a community on the Pacific coast because on occasion it was used as a IED, I guess, is what you'd say. And indeed, they showed me other sort of the improvised, that's your word, the improvised explosives, which was, you know, as simple as the push on a plastic syringe. So, of course, they can't be detected by the metal detectors. How do you go about finding these things then? I mean, you years of experience, I suppose.
So in Colombia specifically, yes, you know, you do see syringes used as the pressure, mm-hmm. activation mechanism. And what sits on the end of that syringe is typically one of two things. There's either a metal circuit, which has been connected to a battery, which is very easy to detect. Or there is a flash detonator. So at the end of the syringe, there's a chemical component which is then squeezed down into the detonator, creates an exothermic reaction, which sets off the detonator and then the improvised explosive, which again has a metal component to it. So it's very rare that we come across devices that have such a low metal content that they can't be detected.
Okay.
And where they do, we have to physically open up the ground and have a look. So we work up under the National Mine Action Authority, the Descontaminate Colombia, and there is a National Mine Action Standard, which means we need to clear down to a minimum depth of 13 centimeters. And where there is any suspicion that there is no metal content, we actually physically open up the ground using essentially gardening tools in a very safe manner, and we look for it.
And you yourself have been out there and you've done this, you've performed demining yourself?
Oh, absolutely. So all members of the Halo Trust were deminers first. So when I joined the Halo Trust in 2006, the first thing that I did was learn how to swing a metal detector, learn how to find mines, learn how to safely identify them, destroy them, to do it in a systematic and safe fashion, but also to learn just how labor intensive the job is, how the most dangerous part of demining is the sheer boredom that comes with it, which is what a lot of people, I think, don't realize, that, you know, there aren't landmines everywhere. So the vast majority of the metal that we find, and we have to very carefully investigate, isn't a mine. So the real challenge of demining isn't necessarily finding mines. It's keeping levels of discipline and safety within the minefield so that when people do come across dangerous items that they're doing it safely.
But that's it. You say this boredom, but you have to maintain such extreme levels of concentration. You can't think, oh, that's, you know, I've seen this before. It's a shard of metal that's been left over from something else. And so... I'm imagining you, and I'm seeing the photos on the wall here in the Halo offices. To demine, you put on these heavy security vests and the helmet and probably some gloves and so on. But, I mean, is it like, and I'm sorry to trivialize it, but I'm seeing images from that movie, The Hurt Locker, at the moment. Is it a bit like that?
It's not The Hurt Locker. It's nothing like that.
Nothing like that at all.
Just think of everything you know about The Hurt Locker and just put it off to one side somewhere.
Yeah.
And then you've got humanitarian demining over here.
Well, this is what my friends in hostage negotiations told me about that movie with Meg Ryan, which was dreadful. Yeah, take that and think the opposite. So I'm glad we cleared that up.
Okay, red wire, blue wire.
Nothing like
No.
It's not a rule for wiring. Okay, with those things. Perfect. So tell us, you know, I understand, I mean, we know that Colombia, how does Colombia rank in terms of countries that are suffering from landmines?
Well, look at the victim rate. I mean, it speaks for itself. It is unacceptably high. So continues to this day. So to that degree, you know, it ranks as one of the more heavily impacted countries right now because of its accident rate.
Mm-hmm. I was told, again, in previous interviews, previous life, I think, when I was paid Jones, I was told that a lot of the mines placed, let's say, by the guerrilla groups, we don't need to name any, but a lot of the mines were placed in areas of great importance in near to communities, let's say by a water source or on maybe a football field, so things to really damage or displace these communities, to instill the fear. Is this, am I on the right track with this, where they're placed?
Well, that's how they end up.
Okay.
So by creating fear and inhibiting access to local communities. But when they're in place, they're typically done, especially in Colombia, very strategically.
Mm.
So it's not like, you know, Cambodia, when I was there, we were destroying 37,000, 38,000 mines per year. We don't have that that number, that density of mine laying. So the mines and the improvised devices that are placed here are done very strategically. Mm-hmm. So they're typically, the value of a landmine is that it's a soldier that doesn't sleep. Yeah. So it's placed in areas of dead ground that either can't be covered by fire or by observation, obvious access routes that they can't protect because they don't have enough people to do that, or for whatever strategic reason. But typically they're placed along paths, access roads, within a couple of meters off the sides of the path is what we find here, which now inhibits access to infrastructure, to water, to agricultural projects, to nearby veredas, access between communities, access to economics and infrastructure. But at the time it was restricting access for the military to sneak up on them. And the same thing around defensive positions. So where they have a base camp, you know, there's strategic laying of improvised explosive devices, either with tripwires or up in trees or under the ground, either as a warning mechanism or to protect access routes. So where we will find these things will either be strategically laid around old bases or inhibiting access to whatever it is that they were trying to control.
I find it's that issue then, and these let's say torches or routes that you would use to get to some of the, you know, Colombia's forgotten, isolated communities that have been disproportionately impacted by the violence of, you know, dating back to 1952, 64, whatever. But I see you've got these landmines then a couple of meters off the road. So you've got to be incredible. I mean, as basic as it is, another vehicle comes the other way, you just can't pull off. This has got to be, I'm thinking of the most basic issue. You come head to head with like a construction truck, you can't pull off the road because you can't be sure that there aren't landmines there. This is a really, really tense job. I mean, I'm getting these images of just these stress points near to various towns and so on. But if we talk about Colombia as a whole, I mean, which are the regions or the departments that are the most affected? I'm always reading small updates from either the military or in the press. Is it somewhere in Antioquia? It's now free of mines, and somewhere in Santander, I guess it was San Vicente Chucurí quite recently, well, maybe over a year ago or so. But where are we looking at the worst places in Colombia?
The highest number of actors and victims historically has been Antioquia, which is why we established a presence there 10 years ago when we began seeking our accreditation, why we started our operations there in 2013, and why we still have a presence there today. When we're looking around where current accident victims are happening, you know, we're looking at Cauca, Valle del Cauca, historically in Meta, in Putumayo, Nariño, Santander, Norte Santander, Choco. These are the departments that are most heavily affected.
These are guerrilla strategic routes for the guerrillas to fight guerrillas and so on. I mean, with these regions, and I'm thinking of recent weeks with, for example, the strikes and the protests that went on in the south in Cauca and so on. I mean, there must be issues around these areas as well, where all of these communities are passing through, where all of, like, say, indigenous groups or farmers are leaving their farms to go up and strike. They're also putting themselves at risk, you know, this migration. The story is not, I mean, is it improving? I mean, let's talk about Meta, for example. This is a strategic, obviously, very strategic department, you know, linking up through Casanare and so on up through Boyacá and, you know, access to the capital. I can see some blue areas and some dark blue areas and so on. I mean, that must be indicating a real density of landmines.
So our area of operations is predominantly in areas that were were previously under control of different groups. These are access routes typically for the movement of illicit trade and for the protection of infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So that's why we continue to see accident victims rising. It's predominantly looking at the protection of illicit activity. So that is why a lot of the focus in the current accidents that are happening are within these areas. And unfortunately, the greatest tragedy of it is that the lack of security in these areas really makes it difficult for organizations like us. We're a non-governmental, we're a non-military organization. To set the security conditions that allow our people to go in and actually find these things and destroy them. So as a civil humanitarian demining organization, you know, we're really limited by that to a degree, which is why looking at concepts like emergency mine risk education, getting out into these areas, speaking with the local communities, teaching them what these devices look like and how to create safe behaviors when they come across them, is so incredibly important. But you know, looking at areas like Meta, so the mine laying that we are dealing with in Meta, the mines were predominantly laid in the early 2000s, early to mid 2000s, continue to affect the local communities.
It must be very frustrating knowing that they're there and not being able to go out for security reasons. What I know also, Colombia presents, I don't know if it's more than other places or if it's more complex or so on, but with the instability of like the geological conditions and the topography, landslides, floods and so on, this moves the location of these mines.
Not to the degree that you would otherwise think. Okay. So, but yes, you know, when you're looking at geomorphology, you're typically looking at very slow movements of soil. But the mines do move into rivers, and then they do get washed downstream. Your landslides do occur, and they do cover up previously mined ground. It's not something that's a typical problem that we need to solve. Where we do come across it, you know, we do have ways of dealing with these things. So we typically have to excavate ground back down to the original surface layer and then go looking.
That's frustrating.
it can be frustrating, but it's not insurmountable.
Okay.
And that's the beauty of the landmine problem. It's solvable.
Okay.
So I was a program manager in Mozambique in 2015. Mm-hmm. When we declared Mozambique to be mine free. So that was a country that was considered to be unsolvable, 50 to 100 years, millions of mines, and it was considered to be unachievable. Mm-hmm. And what we demonstrated in Mozambique in 2015 is what HALO's been saying since it began in 1988 in Afghanistan, is that landmines, when you clear a landmine, it doesn't grow back. Mm-hmm. It's a solvable problem. It's what we've demonstrated in the various municipalities in which we're working, where we get to hand over ground that was formerly mined back to productive use. And when you do that, when you empower the local community to boost their own economic potential, to give them opportunities with ground to take care of their families and to give them the same opportunities as everybody else, they value that, and there's a real benefit to doing that, and that is why we've managed to hand over three municipalities so far as mine free. One of the first things I got to do when I came to Colombia was we handed over a zone within the municipality in Tolima and Chaparral is mine free. Okay. And by the middle of this year we should complete our operations in Tolima.
Really?
So there are minefields that continue to need to be cleared, and this is being done by the Humanitarian Demining Brigade. So we're working in conjunction with the brigade in clearing Tolima of its mine problem. Mm-hmm. The birthplace of the FARC will be mine-free. We will finish our operations in Tolima this year, and we will leave. And that will allow us to focus on other areas where accidents are happening, where we can redeploy our teams and we can get on with the job. But the mine problem is solvable. And what is happening this year, which is fascinating, is under the leadership of the new government, formulating a new national mine action strategy. So Colombia, you know, has made an international commitment under the Ottawa Mine Ban Convention to be mine free. So they currently have a deadline of 2021. They're looking to reassess that and to get the support and the momentum that they need to be able to get the job finished. And if we can do that, then we will solve the mine problem. We can focus on other parts of the world.
That's 2021, I think, needs to be readdressed perhaps, but Tolima being mine-free, it sets a very important precedent, I say, the birthplace of the FARC. Am I mistaken in saying that the Cañón de las Hermosillas in Tolima, is it that area, so they presumably mined the entrance to there, which is one of the great hiding places. Before we get on to the community work, because I know that the Halo Trust is very involved, just give us some numbers. I know you said at the beginning, but how many victims of landmines do we have here in Colombia right now?
It's just under 12,000.
That's a lot of people.
It's an unacceptably high number.
And that's including deaths?
Yes, absolutely.
And maimed and... Oh. And how many landmines do we estimate that there are in the country at this moment? You can't say.
That is an impossible question to answer. Well,
you were so happy in the last segment that I thought I could bring that question. Let's bring him back down again.
I mean, that's the real challenge that the government has ahead of it at the moment in submitting its Ottawa request. It's something that, you know, that we're really looking forward to sort of helping with and trying to figure that out. The first thing you need to do is how big the problem is that you need solved, and then how many resources that you need in order to be able to deal with it. We just don't know.
Okay. So now,
and as a frame of reference, you know, Mozambique, we talked about millions of mines, just over 200,000.
Wow.
You know, so many of the original estimates from 10, 20 years ago when, you know, 10 years ago when I first got into this industry, vastly overstated. The problem is typically smaller than original estimates. But we just won't know until we're done.
Yeah, that is true. So now let's go move on to the community activity, because one thing that I find incredible is it's not just you guys that go into the community and sort of, let's say, sift through the earth and dig down the 13 centimeters. You train up the local communities to become experts in this field as well. I mean, how is this, let's say, taken on board by these communities? My immediate reaction is like, that's a risky job. So in your experience, how has this been received?
So, It's a job just like any other job.
Okay.
It comes with its own inherent risks, which you can mitigate. Mm-hmm. So the dangerous part of a mine, if it's pressure initiated, is on the top.
Okay.
So don't put pressure there. You know, so how we go about systematically searching for, investigating, and then destroying explosive items, there's a series of procedures that you can teach anyone, mm-hmm. anywhere.
Right.
So we are, you know, the largest demining organization in the world. You know, we work in over 25 different countries and territories. We employ about 8,500 people around the world. Most of them are not white.
Mm-hmm.
Vast majority of people that we employ are from the communities that are affected by the mines. And the reason why we do that, there's a number of different benefits in doing that. One of which is that they typically know their mine problem better than anybody else. They're our best source of information.
Mm-hmm.
The work that we do is entirely based on consent. And we work in humanitarian space and we work on the basis of consent. People don't want us somewhere, we can't operate there. So, you know, the community liaison activities that we conduct, the confidence that we need to build in the local communities to tell us where the mines are in the first place, the fact that we're not the government, that, you know, trying to build a level of trust in local communities that they can share information, And sometimes the simplest way of doing that is just being that community. So employing people from the areas in which we work in, you know, they're our best source of information. They tell us what we need to know about the local area, about what the security conditions are, about any issues that, that we need to be made aware of so that we can continue doing the work that we do. But it also provides people with a living wage. Mm-hmm. So we're not only giving people jobs and skills, but we're investing in the local community. So we employ people, but we also, you know, we invest in the local economies while we're there. So a lot of the food that we buy, a lot of the provisions, a lot of the money that we spend as a non-governmental organization typically goes into the most affected communities. So there's a lot of benefits to employing people in Colombia. I've got a team of just over 510 Colombian staff.
Wow.
Who typically come from all seven departments in which we're currently operating in. And it's a model that we use all over the world. It's a very, very few international staff, the minimum number possible, typically because we're an expensive bunch.
Yeah.
And you just don't need someone like me to clear a minefield. You know, anyone can do it.
Okay. It scared me a little bit how blasé. Well, it's a pressure one. Don't put pressure on it. It's like, I don't want to go out there. But anyway.
Systematic application of common sense.
Okay. Very good. we're definitely on message. And one question then, if you talk about this consent, have you had communities here in Colombia that have not given their consent for you to be there? Can you say that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Oh. So we're very careful about where we put our people. So, you know, one of the fundamental principles that we operate under is do no harm, and that also, you know, extends to our people. I will not put my teams in a dangerous position. We've had to withdraw from some municipalities. So very recently in July of last year, we had one of our vehicles detained and burned, and threats were made against our staff not to return. So we take those threats very seriously. So and we adapt to our area of operation accordingly. So So that's one example of where we've had to actually withdraw teams. And another would be in places in Cauca, where it took us a significant period of time to gain confidence from the local communities to allow us access in the first place. And if they say no, well, you know, we can't force the issue any further. The only thing that we can do is clear the nearby vereda. Because confidence breeds confidence, you know, success breeds success, and ultimately people will learn to trust us when they discover that the only thing that we want to do is come and clear their landmines.
And Cauca, of course, not being government is a huge benefit. It goes without saying, you probably can't tell me where your car was burned, but I'm sure I could look it up online.
In Uribe.
Oh, really?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Really? I there's no secret to this. So
the heart of the parliament.
We're operating in a changing humanitarian space across Colombia.
Yeah.
Security is an increasing concern. How we go about setting the conditions for our teams to be able to continue doing the work that they need to do in an environment that is fluctuating.
Mm-hmm.
It is my biggest challenge this year.
Yeah, definitely. I'm just closing this off because it's been remarkably informative. I did not know how much the Halo Trust really, you know, was present here and with how many people you're employing. But through local communities in Colombia, you must be like the number one employer in some of these towns. Those who aren't working and, you know, working with, because these are, I mean, largely, I would say, agrarian communities that where you end up going to. But in your experience across the world, how have you found the communities where you've worked in Colombia? How have you found the reaction to your presence?
A broad mixture. So some are highly distrustful.
Really?
to begin with. until, you know, until that confidence is built. As I said, you know, success breeds success, and sometimes clearing a nearby verrata is your strongest public relations tool that you have, is just being professionally competent. But the team that I work with here, you know, they're young, they're enthusiastic, they're well educated, they're keen, and they're able. You know, so working in Colombia is, you know, it's a significant pleasure. You know, so in my business, you always look. Well, personally, I always look down the chain of command for inspiration, and you know, I joined this organization to get mines out of the ground, and the teams that are out there doing it are the ones who are, you know, who are the true champions of humanitarian demining globally. And I'm really proud of my deminers here. I think they're doing a good job. You know, there's always areas for improvement, and you know, if there weren't, then I'd be out of a job, quite honestly. And I think in Colombia there is room for improvement, and there's a lot that we're doing with my team now in order to try to make sure that we can, you know, that we can improve the value for money that we're providing for the people who pay for the work that we do, so that we can provide greater impact for every dollar that's donated.
Well, you've definitely had your press training over the years. You've been on message the whole way through this 35 minutes, not strayed at all. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time to tell us a little bit about the Halo Trust work internationally, and of course here in Colombia, which is of most interest to us. It has been incredibly informative. So thank you for taking, you know, this time out of your really busy day. You're about to move offices. So we're here in one office, and maybe next time when you've cleared all of Colombia of mines, and if I'm still running the podcast, we'll get you all back on again.
Why don't you come out and visit us, and I'll show you a minefield in action.
Do you think my wife would possibly let me do that? She's a Santanderiana. These are the women who are wear the trousers in the relationship, let's say that. But
we can always not tell her.
Yeah, this is true. I would love to come out. I would love to come out and write some stuff about it, or do, you know, do an on the ground interview. I think it would be fantastic to do. But that's something we can talk about off mic. This has been episode 271 with the director of the Halo Trust for here in Colombia, Ash Boddy. It's been a great episode. Thank you to the Halo Trust and to Ash, and of course to Natalia in the press office for organizing this. We're signing off for today. Got more people lined up for coming weeks, and of course we'll be back with news updates from Columbia Reports, Adrian Alsamer, who was sick last week. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.